You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. Welcome to our Christmas 2023 book recommendation special with the wonderful Elizabeth Perry from Daunt Books. I love this show. I love recording to Elizabeth, and this is a jam-packed episode full of recommendations for you to pop on your list or buy for your loved ones this Christmas. We are also joined by the author of this month's book club book, Take What You Need, Idra Novi, and we speak to Sophie Flynn about why a Jericho Writers membership should be on your Christmas list this year. You can email the podcast at btmbookclub@gmail.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at btmbookclub, where all the books spoken about on today's episode will be listed. They will also be in the show notes on the podcast. Enjoy the show. Anyone who listens to the Brighton Book Club will know that one of my favourite shows of the year is our Christmas recommendation special, which I think we've mastered, if I say so myself, a really lovely format for. So I bring on my friend and former Hove City Books bookseller, current manager of Dawn in Summertown in Oxford, Elizabeth Perry, who goes through the list of the top five top selling and most popular five fiction and non-fiction books and suggests alternatives that you may not have heard of. So Elizabeth, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me back. This truly is the highlight of my winter.
And I should also say that you chose our book club book, Take What You Need by Idra Novi, and I'm really, really looking forward to interviewing the author with you at the end of today's show. So without further ado, let's start with fiction.
Okay, so Penance by Eliza Clark has been really big this year.
Brilliant novel.
Me too, she's fantastic. If you haven't already read Penance, you must. But if you have, which is quite likely, I think you might enjoy a novel called Pretty as a Picture by Elizabeth Little, which is also looking at true crime. It's also got some true crime podcast in there. So it's got a similar kind of format to the book, but it's a real page turner. It's very funny, and it's also very interesting on ideas about fame and making art and about the ethics of true crime. So if you're a Penance fan, this is a good one to read next.
So I don't love true crime, but I loved Penance. So do you think I will love Pretty as a Picture?
Absolutely. I'm not a true crime fan either. I've got some quite complicated and strong feelings about it. And I think one of the things I liked so much about Pretty as a Picture is because it held space for those things, as well as being a page turner. It didn't get too bogged down in its ideas, but it's a really thoughtful, interesting, thrilling read. Yeah, I think you'll like it.
So second, we have In Memorandum by Alice Wynne, which is actually one of the books that you recommended this spring as one of your spring reads. So if anything, you're basically a fortune teller for books, because this has won awards.
Yes, not as many as I thought it would, but some. Yes, it's so brilliant. Another one that I would imagine lots of your listeners might have already picked up and read, but if they haven't, you must read it. Beautiful romance, dual narrative, set during World War One. and so if you've read that and enjoyed it and looking for something else, I absolutely loved Ghost Girl Banana by Wiz Wharton, which is another dual narrative novel, and it does the same thing that In Memoriam does, in that both voices are so compelling, you just keep going between the two, very excited to read the next part of the book. I think sometimes with this kind of novel, you find yourself almost skipping ahead to get back to the story that you're more interested in, but both of these books, both strands are so compelling and interesting. Little bit of history in Ghost Girl Banana as well. But yeah, two fantastic novels.
Amazing. So next is a book that I haven't read, but I have a copy of, and I know that you absolutely adored, and it's done really well, which is Kay Patrick, who was actually joined by Eliza Clark on the Granter novelist list, actually.
Yes. Yeah. Mrs. S by Kay Patrick is just completely stunning, and I know Anna's going to love it, and I can't believe she hasn't read it yet. It's fantastic and is set in an English boarding school over one very hot summer when the young woman that starts a new job there, who's the narrator, falls in love with the headmaster's wife and everything that sort of comes from that happening. And so I've paired this with one of my favourite novels, which is Dryland by Sarah Jaffe. And that is also set in, I guess, kind of like school-ish. It's not a boarding school and it's in America, but it really captures both the queer experience and the experience of being a teenager so well that you see through the eyes of the narrator and Mrs. S. I almost think of the two of them as a pair of books where Mrs. S is the teachers and Dryland is the students. So if you've liked Mrs. S, I think definitely read Dryland next.
There's something about things set in schools and in boarding schools that is really appealing. So, number four, we're doing some cozy crime.
So Jessie Satanto's novel, Vera Wong's Unsolicited Advice for Murderers, is one that I picked up earlier this year and read in an afternoon. It's cozy crime. It's about a woman who takes it upon herself to solve a mystery because she doesn't think the police are going to do a very good job. And the police are not very impressed with her approach to solving mysteries. And there's lots of hilarity from that, but also really heartwarming characters. It's real cozy crime, like the best kind of possible cozy crime. If you've read and enjoyed that, you must try one of Mia P. Manansala's books. She's written a series called Tita Rosie's Kitchen Mysteries, which I've talked about on this podcast before, and she's just had a new book out called Murder and Mammon, which is, I think it's my favorite cozy crime series. If you've enjoyed any of the Richard Osman, that sort of thing, if you liked Vera Wong, you should definitely start the series as soon as possible because you're just going to fall in love with them.
And last but not least on our fiction list, we have a book called The List by Yomi Adegoke. I have read this. I actually listened to it on Audible, which was a gorgeous experience. And it's done really well this year, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. And I've paired this one with a novel called More Than You'll Ever Know by Katie Gutierrez, which is quite different in some ways. It's the story of, actually, I've just realized it's kind of about true crime as well, which is interesting. There's a journalist who's very interested in the story of a woman many years ago who's living a double life with two husbands until the day that one husband found out and shot the other one. And the journalist decides she wants to try and find this woman and ask her what happened and what went on. And the two of them become sort of friends, but also there's this interviewee tension there as well. And there's a lot in it about the ethics of true crime and who gets to tell stories. But the reason I've paired it with The List is I think it's a brilliant thriller that's kind of unpacking gender and power in a similar way. And you get both perspectives the way that you do in The List. So you hear all these different versions of a similar story, and you have to kind of come to your own conclusion about who made decisions and why. It's brilliant.
I love that. Stylistically, it kind of brings to mind Opal and Nev, which you recommended last year, which was one of my favorite books, actually. I just thought it was stunning.
I agree. And I think that's a good comparison as well.
So, non-fiction, everyone's favorite teen singer, icon, slightly bizarre dancer on Instagram, Britney Spears, The Woman in Me. Have you read The Woman in Me yet?
I listened to it and I thought it was fantastic. I think Michelle Williams reads it. And I really, really recommend the audiobook in particular. Yes, obviously you don't really need to say anything about it. It's Britney Spears. We've all been waiting for it. It's really exciting to hear her talk about her life in her own words. And I think every Christmas there's lots of celebrity memoirs, and not all of them are always worth picking up. But I think this one is. And another one that I was really impressed by is Page Boy by Elliot Page, which came out earlier this year. And it's such a beautiful memoir. And similar to Britney's, it's kind of unpicking the slightly darker side of fame and of like big cultural moments that we might know and love. So like Elliot talks about his time on the film Juno, and you hear a little bit of what was going on behind the scenes there. But it's also just a really good read, beautifully written. And I would recommend both of them.
Amazing. So what do we have next? Nina Stibbe.
Yes, so Nina Stibbe's new book, Went to London and Took the Dog, is her diary of a year spent living in London. She describes herself as a 60-year-old runaway. And on the surface, it's the sort of book that I think people will think of as quite lighthearted. And it is very funny, but it's also a really honest, serious look at menopause and big changes in life happening when you maybe don't expect them, and the adjustments that you might have to make, finding your own kind of community and deciding what you want the rest of your life to look like. So it's not just laugh out loud funny. It is also, I think, a really beautiful, moving book. And similarly, I really loved Small Fires by Rebecca May Johnson, which is a kind of memoir looking at cooking, but looking at the kitchen as a place of really serious critical thought rather than just a domestic space where, cooking happens and it doesn't really matter. It's another book that's taking something quite familiar, but on the surface could be seen as kind of like lighthearted or lovely, and really looks at the interesting, complicated, fascinating facets of what it means to cook, what it means to be in the kitchen, what it means to follow a recipe. A beautiful book.
And what do we have next?
So next up is Killers of the Flower Moon by David Gran, which came out a little while ago, but is back because of the film adaptation by Martin Scorsese. I think the book is wonderful. I really hope people read the book. And although the film is very long, I think there's a lot that isn't in it. So I'd really recommend the book to get the full story. And I'm pairing it with another kind of historical crime non-fiction read, which is Furious Hours by Casey Sepp. And it's a fascinating book. It's about Harper Lee, who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, and this true crime book that she tried to write and never was quite able to figure out how to tell the story. And so Casey's book is almost like a missing person investigation, but the missing person is this book that Harper Lee never wrote. So it's also got the historical crime that Harper Lee was investigating, and in that way it's quite similar to Killers of the Flower Moon, but it's also an investigation into trying to write a book and why that can be incredibly difficult.
People are so clever.
They really are. Yeah.
That is amazing. What's our penultimate non-fiction pairing?
So The Golden Mole by Katherine Rundell is a beautiful treasure trove of nature writing. And I've paired it with Uprooting by Marcel Farrell, which combines nature writing and history as well, but also with some memoir in there. So Marcel's thinking about her childhood in Trinidad and her attempts to make a home in sort of peaceful English countryside that on the surface you'd maybe think is very different, but she starts to see these similarities there in the landscape. Beautiful nature writing, interesting historical moments, and also really, really beautiful memoir.
Amazing. And last but not least, what do we have?
So another memoir, Stay True by Hua Xu, is a beautiful, very slim book about a friendship that the author had in college that was cut short by his friend being killed. And it's a real time capsule of when they knew each other, what their friendship was like, and the sense of loss. And so I've paired it with This Ragged Grace by Octavia Bright, which is another memoir. And similarly, it's really beautiful writing on grief and on time and on what it means to try and make a life and live a life. There's lots of art writing in there as well. They're both beautiful books, and I think make a really interesting pair of books to read together.
Well, as ever, thank you so much. That's just great to have. I've just been making loads of notes of gifts that I'm going to be buying people from your recommendations because they never cease to impress me. I would love to know what your best book of 2023 has been, your favorite read.
This was so hard. I think this was a great year for so many different areas of reading that I love. Fiction was great, non-fiction was great, but the one that I keep coming back to is Open Throat by Henry Hoke, which is a novel narrated by a queer mountain lion living in the Hollywood Hills.
Wait, what?
I know. So, like, as a one-line pitch, that's completely baffling. But it is completely electric. It's the best novel I've read on climate change, on being an outsider, on what human living does to a natural landscape. It's funny, it's weird, it shouldn't work nearly as well as it does. It's the perfect length, so it's very short. Every word really counts. I don't know how Henry Hoke has done it, but it really feels like a future classic. And I can't believe there was a point when I first heard the pitch, when I first heard that sentence, it's a queer mountain lion living in the Hollywood Hills. And I remember thinking, I don't know how that's going to work. And now I can't believe I ever didn't think it was going to be great. So, yeah, I can't recommend it enough. No matter how that sentence about a queer mountain lion makes you feel, pick up the book and read it.
Amazing. And just a reminder, what's it called and who's it by?
It's Open Throat by Henry Hoke.
That is such a good title. And while I don't want non-fiction to feel left out, was there any non-fiction that you read this year that really stuck with you?
There was a lot, yeah. I think my favorite non-fiction read of the year was probably Page Boy, which I mentioned, the memoir by Elliot Page. I think because in many ways I was interested in picking up the book and reading his story and wasn't expecting it to be so well written. So that was a really nice surprise. And Elliot is clearly a big reader as well. So it also led me to lots of recommendations by other writers that I hadn't come across. But yeah, I didn't expect it. It's harsh, but I didn't expect it going into a celebrity memoir to come out with all these recommendations for other books as well.
I think that just goes to show, doesn't it, that like nothing is very black and white, and there's definitely a lot of kind of snobbery in the industry about celebrity memoir, but essentially a good book's a good book.
Completely.
And there's a lot of very bad fiction written by very famous people
So
mentioning.
many,
Is
so many.
there anything you're really looking forward to for next year?
There are lots of things I'm really looking forward to next year. There's one book in particular that I'm already certain is going to be my book of the year. I love it so much. I think about it all the time. It's called Headshot by Rita Bullwinkle. It comes out in spring next year from Daunt Books, and I read the manuscript in one go on my phone. I couldn't put it down. I hate reading books like that, but it's a novel that takes place over 2 days of a boxing tournament for the best girl boxers in the US. And each chapter is structured, it's each fight between the girls. So you're in the head of each girl as she comes to her fight. It's just phenomenal. It's the best book I've read about existing in a body. It's so good at the awkwardness of teenage sort of weirdness, but coupled with this really quite grown up ambition and drive to beat the crap out of somebody else. And then you also get these little snapshots of what will happen in the future for each girl. So does she remember the fight when she's older? This thing that feels so important in the moment, is it actually something she ever thinks about again? It's so good. It's just so good. I'm so excited for it to come
That sounds
out.
amazing. And can you remind us what it's called and who it's by?
It's called Headshot and it's by Rita Bullwinkle.
That sounds amazing. I'm absolutely putting that on my TBR pile. Thank you so much, as ever, for joining us and filling us with your wisdom and your recommendations. They always feel really meaningful, and it just really means a lot. This is a period of the year where, in the kind of book world, there were a lot of lists, and I think that they can be, really good, but they often really feature the same people again and again. Often because they're great books, but there are also so many other great books out there, which is why I absolutely love what you do. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me back.
So, are you ready to bring on Idra Novi and to talk about this amazing book that you recommended, Take What You Need?
Yes, I am so excited. I can't wait.
Idra Novi is a novelist, poet, and translator. Her most recent novel, Take What You Need, was named a spring fiction pick with the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and selected as one of the New Yorker's best books of 2023 so far. Her first novel, Ways to Disappear, was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for First Fiction, and her second novel, Those Who Knew, was a finalist in the 2019 Clark Fiction Prize.
Her fiction and poetry have been translated into a dozen languages, and she's written for the New York Times, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and The Guardian. In 2022, she received a Pushcart Prize for her story The Glacier, published in the Yale Review. Her works as a translator include Clarice Lispector's novel The Passion According to G.H. and a co-translation with Ahmad Nadilizadeh of Iranian poet Garis Abdolmalekian. Lean Against This Late Hour, a finalist for the Pen America Poetry and Translation Prize in 2021. Her new book of poems, Soon and Holy, will be published in 2024. She teaches fiction at Princeton University.
Elizabeth, you put me onto this book because I said, right, what shall I choose for the next book club book? And you gave me a choice of a couple, and I went for this one because it sounded like something I'd really love. I love a dusty American novel, and I just genuinely, I'm quite shallow, and I thought the cover was very beautiful. What was it about this book that made it something that you were so keen to recommend?
There was so much of it that I loved and immediately wanted to talk about, and I think that's always a good sign. And I read it before it was published, so there weren't many people I could talk to about it. And I found myself thinking about the characters nearly nonstop. And I think that for me is probably the heart of why I love this book so much, is both Jean and Leah felt so real and so interesting. And I thought about them and worried about them like they were friends, and felt so, I guess, kind of invested in their stories in the book. It was that element of, it felt real, like while reading the book it felt true, and that's really special in fiction. And I think a big part of that was the writing about art, which is not easy to do, but everything in it felt like I was really seeing the sculptures, I was really in the house, I was really hearing what was going around, and I thought that was beautiful.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And then we're really excited because Idra actually joins us on the Brighton Book Club. So welcome. It's great to have you here. Can you tell us a bit about this novel?
Well, first, I would like to thank you both. It's an honor to share this novel with both of you. And it just means so much to know you deeply connected with it. And I'm just really thrilled to share it with all the readers with the Brighton Book Club. So I just wanted to extend my thanks to both of you. And, you know, these characters came to feel like real people and friends to me too. Like, you know, when I finished writing this book and I was so, like, could still hear Jean in my head. Like, I think I really mourned the end of a relationship with her, which seems sort of strange because I invented her, but in some way she came so alive to me, and her company provided like a, I don't know, a sense, you know, she just has such moxie, you know, such verve that I sort of channeling her voice, I think really enlivened my days. So I missed her company in that way.
Can you read us, please, from the beginning of the book?
Yes. So this opening section is from Leah's point of view, on her way to travel back to the town in Appalachia where Jean was her stepmother. This morning, I read that repeating the name of the deceased can quiet the mind when grieving for a complicated person. My stepmother Jean was a complicated person. I've been reading all kinds of advice since hearing of her death. I didn't know that she'd begun to weld metal towers in her living room, towers so tall she needed a ladder to complete them. Apparently, that's how she died, slipping from one of the ladder's highest rungs. Jean never left the town where she was born, or where I was also born, and where she became the closest version of a mother I've known. It's a town in the southern Allegheny Mountains, which have been sinking for millions of years and resemble rolling hills now more than mountains. I know uttering Jean's name won't quiet my mind any more than saying the word mountain will stop these hills from sinking further. My use of the word stepmother, while soothing, is wishful thinking too. Jean left my father when I was 10 and hasn't technically been my stepmother for decades. I've gone through phases of calling her up, seeking her contrarian take on things. Just as often, it's felt saner to stop all contact, and over the past 4 years, we've had none. Despite our prolonged recent silence, she left her towers to me. I received the news of all this from a man named Elliot, who claims he's been living with Jean for some time. He was reluctant to elaborate on the phone, beyond explaining that he was at the hardware store when Jean fell from the ladder. He drove her to the hospital, he said, as soon as he found her unconscious on the floor. I'm driving toward Jean's house now, trying to give this man the benefit of the doubt, to imagine him grieving for her as well. Early this morning, I rented a car near my building in Long Island City. It takes hours to cross the tilled middle of Pennsylvania, and I'm not alone in this compact rental car. I have a young son in the backseat and a husband sitting next to me who isn't from this country and has never driven into the Allegheny Mountains before. I planned on bringing my family here at some point, once the country was less polarized, or after Jean wrote first, or after I caved and sent a few words to her. I work all day with words, revising them in multiple languages before they move on to websites. And yet these past 4 years, I haven't been able to move even a single sentence in Jean's direction. Beside me in the car, my husband Gerardo is sighing. The road before us has narrowed to two lanes, and for several miles, we've been trapped behind a blue pickup truck with several long plastic tubes rattling around in the back. According to GPS, it'll now be an additional 12 minutes until we reach Jean's driveway, and conjuring her name has yet to resolve the disquiet in my mind. Each time I say Jean's name to myself, I hear her even louder, the rising pleasure in her voice when she read me fairy tales, stopping to insist that she wasn't like the stepmother in Snow White, that she had no craving for my liver or my lungs. All I want is to nibble at your heart, Leah, she'd tell me. You don't mind if I eat your heart sometimes, right? Just one of your ventricles. I'd play along. I'd tell Jean to eat my whole heart if she was hungry enough. We had such fun slipping bits of ourselves into the savage parts. I've yet to read any of those grim tales to my son. I've stuck to newer books for him, to stories that stir up nothing from my childhood and present no risk of Jean creeping into my voice. It's felt like a neat and necessary excision, leaving out Jean and the confusing appetites of those old tales. I'm fumbling enough already, ambling motherless into motherhood. Except now there is no Jean. She's fallen to this odd fairy tale death while living with a man I know nothing about. I hope what Elliot said on the phone about her slipping from the ladder is true and that Jean died in the rapture of making these towers. Maybe my grief will be easier to bear over these last few hills if I keep this fairy tale going in my mind. I know even fairy tales that bend toward mercy have their brutal twist, and there's no returning to these hills without allowing Jean to gnaw at my heart again, to chew on my ventricles like strips of venison. In the backseat, my son Silvestre is restless and flailing his legs. I offer him the last of the apple slices I prepared for our long trip into these sinking mountains. I assure him this old truck with its rattling plastic tubes won't remain ahead of us forever.
It's so nice to hear you read that. I love hearing the author read their own work. It's just absolutely beautiful. I could actually listen to you read the whole book.
Oh, well, thank you. I did the audio in the US where Leah's voice, I read Leah's voice because it's more like, you know, imagining this whole thing in her mind. And then Leah was like a professional actor. So the difference between the two of us and the audio is quite different because I'm an author. I'm not a professional actor, but it felt like the distinction between her performance of Jean, who is, you know, sort of the beating heart of the novel, and then me reading it in sort of the sort of self-correcting way that Leah is proceeding. It felt like maybe the contrast would be a good thing because it felt true to the voices, you know, in the book, that one's in present tense and one's in past tense, and you know.
Absolutely.
That's so interesting. I really wanted to ask you about translation, but that almost sounds like a kind of translation, the text becoming audio and then the difference between how you imagine it or how you hear it. But I'd love to know how you feel about the differences between writing and translating, and if you've translated your own books or if somebody else has, what that's like.
Thank you. That's a great question. And I love having an opportunity to talk about translation. I think when I'm thinking about voice in fiction, you know, the difference between the syntax or the cadence of Jean's voice and Leah's voice, that Jean, you know, she lives in this place where she can go through a whole day without seeing anyone but Elliot, right? This man who she's paying and who comes to her house. And so she's kind of unfiltered and she just sort of lets it run. You know, she just goes. Whereas, you know, Leah's navigating a city. She's navigating lots of personality. She's always anticipating other people's reactions. And so I was trying to think how that would be present in the way that they speak and the way that they perceive things. And I think I approach voice from translation that way. You know, when you're translating someone else, like when I'm translating Felicia Lispector, I have to sort of imagine why she chose the things she chose. And so I think the thing that people often think is that translators are interpreting other people's work, but they're not. A good translation should just recreate the mystery of the original, not interpret it, but just recreate it. And so I think I brought that to character, that I'm not trying to interpret Jean. I'm not trying to judge her. I'm just trying to recreate the mystery of her character, you know, and recreate the mystery of Leah's character, not explain them to the reader, but just inhabit them. You know, that may sound sort of like a, you know, sort of like a vague difference, but I guess when you're thinking about writing lines, it is a big difference, right? Because you're not trying to, I think I just don't do the exposition. I'm just like, well, how can you present the mystery that any human being is, right? Like we're all a bunch of, you know, mysterious elements.
That's so great. And I love the way you talk about Jean. There's clearly such a fondness for Jean. I loved Jean personally, and found her really surprising, and would love to know, did you plan her storyline or did she surprise you too? And was there ever a version of the book that had some kind of reconciliation while Jean was alive?
That is a great question. It's funny. Nobody has asked me that. It's, you know, all the interviews I've done, I'm so glad you asked that. I actually really struggled with the end of this book. And I have a friend, Renee Stanky, who's a novelist, and we would loop the park here. And I would like sort of go through all these iterations. And it took a while to find sort of, you know, what you said, Elizabeth, the thing that felt true to the story and the world of these characters. And I don't want to give the ending away, but it felt like what they needed to was that the reconciliation would happen through the art. In the way that, I don't know, in these very polarized times that we're in, that seem to just get more polarized every news cycle, you know, is the sense that, like, where can the meeting ground happen? And can art be the meeting ground? Can sculpture be the meeting ground? Can a novel be the meeting ground? So that, you know, these two people who are really disappointed and sort of fearful about each other, like, where can some sort of giving way happen? If it's not face-to-face, could it happen through a work of art, you know?
I'm so interested to hear that, because I love the ending. I'm going to try not to spoil it either, but there's an ambiguity there that made me almost tearful when I finished the book. It was quite an emotional experience. In the different versions of the ending, was there always going to be something a little ambiguous about it? Or did you ever have a version where something very solid and real was going to happen?
That's, yes. I mean, I think solid and real is so tricky when you're thinking about fiction, because, you know, all of it is both as solid as you want it to be, and also completely, you know, this invented realm. And I did play it around with a lot of different things. And I think what ultimately felt, you know, most emotionally true was that there would be this ambiguity that would call upon the reader to sort of actively imagine the existence of Jean's art and imagine it having a life. And that to me felt, I'm glad it felt like an emotional experience reading the end, because I wanted the end to read like an invitation, you know, like, can you open your heart to the possibility of Jean's art? You know, can you, that was an unfortunate rhyme, but, you know, like, can you, yeah, you know, like, how can reading create the possibility for something in reality? You know, like, whose work are we missing? Whose art are we not seeing? You know, whose art are we disregarding? And I think the ambiguity felt necessary in order for the reader to sort of find their own way to thinking about that, and wherever they live, you know, you walk down the street or you see something and you're like, oh, well, that house is going to get bulldozed. Like, what was in there? Like, what beautiful work might we be missing out on? Because we just don't expect serious or meaningful art to occur in some town or street where you don't expect it to happen.
So we're going to move on in a bit to talk a bit about gene sculptures and the art, because it's something that fascinated both of us. But before that, I'd really like to talk a bit about the dual perspective, which is a form that I absolutely love in writing. And Jean and Leah's voices are so distinctive. Did you write them kind of one all at once and then the other one all at once? Or did you write them kind of chronologically as we read them?
Well, that was a tricky aspect of this book, because I knew I wanted the two voices, but figuring out that one would be in the present tense and one would be in the past. And what would happen is I would get something I was really excited about at one of Jean's chapters, and then I would sort of boomerang and I would have to rewrite Leah's. Or I added something to Leah's of like a flashback between Jean and her father and his sort of inhibition about artistic expression. And that he had sort of, you know, Jean's father grew up where it was sort of like, you know, men would get made fun of for having, you know, artistic aspirations. And so how did that impact Jean? And then what would Leah remember? And then I would like go back to Jean. So I think that, you know, I was sort of deep in them depending on what I wrote in one or the other. So they sort of, you know, working on one would kind of surprise me in a way that would take me back to the other. So I kept sort of shifting between them, you know, and I would add something and then I'd be like, oh, well, what would that character remember differently? You know? So, I don't know. I think it was a way to write these two women who long for each other, but who have also stubbornly limited their ability to mourn the loss of that relationship, you know? And so, you know, I think there's something that can happen when there is a, you know, disagreement. How does that affect the way that you feel like you can be honest about who you long for? Because there's like such a profound disappointment there. You know, it makes mourning very complicated.
I've heard a few authors who've written dual perspective novels talk about things that they did to get into the heads of particular characters. So, for example, having a playlist for one character that's then very different music to the playlist for the other one. Was there anything that you did to get into Jean and Leah's heads separately?
Well, I love hearing what other people have done to sort of, because I think there's something inherently democratic about multiple points of view, right? Because then you can kind of see that each one's perception is limited and it's a sliver of what's going on. And, you know, they just sort of get their vote in sort of what's happening, but it like requires, you know, multiple voices. So Jean's spirit is based on a woman who became a friend of mine in my hometown. And she let me record her speaking. And, her name's Helen, and she had such pizzazz and has such vitality. And I would listen to recordings of her every day before I wrote Jean sections, you know, there, and sometimes even the same lines would just be a couple lines where like, you know, Jean, the second, you know, you hear her voice, she sounds so, there's like, sort of this like, energy to it that, you know, just brings her completely to life as this very distinctive voice. And I think that came from Helen. They're not the same person, but, you know, I call her all the time. You know, through this book, we became close friends. And the second I hear her voice on the phone, I just, you know, I want to, you know, go out and torch something. So I felt like I would listen to her voice because I think that she has this like spark in her that's immediately apparent. And, you know, it's contagious too. Like she kind of ignites a spark whenever I hear her voice.
How lovely. What a kind of amazing compliment to someone to, you know, love them so much that you want to immortalize them in that way. So let's talk about Jean's sculptures, because these were fascinating. I have quite a lot of questions. Firstly, are they based on real art? And secondly, why sculpture? Why not some other sort of art form? Why not kind of painting or watercolor? Why did it have to be these big kind of brutal sculptures?
Wow, the two of you have such fabulous questions. So my family has a scrapyard that, like this scrapyard that Jean, where she gets her free scrap metal in the novel, was patrilineal. So it went from my great-grandfather to my grandfather, to my great grandfather, to his son, to his son, to his son, and my grandmother, because she was a daughter, you know, it wasn't even that big of a scrapyard, but you know, it was just, it was went down through the men in the family. So I never had any material connection to it, but I did know it existed. And my great grandmother who started the scrapyard, her name was Ida Novi. So I have almost her name, which I took, by the way, you know, I took Novi. And so I love the metaphor of scrap recycling, that you take something that's considered a discard and you turn it into something new. It always felt like what you do with life or what you do with words, right? Is that you recycle them and you turn them into something new. So metaphorically, I really like this idea of my namesake and her scrapyard, but it didn't belong to me. And I'd actually had never even been there. So in the process of writing this novel, I did visit and part to sort of get a sense of how the scrapyard operates when Jean's going to get her scrap metal from what she, in the novel is called the Levy scrapyard, not the Novi scrapyard. And in fact, she refers to her cousin Marty, and my cousin Marty is the descendant who currently runs the Novi scrapyard. And so he found that kind of funny that like I kept his name as the, you know, descendant who gives the free metal to Jean. So that was why I wanted to work with metal. But I also was very interested in how welding is very much a male profession, and how, you know, women, even if you come from a long line of welders, or at least, you know, where I grew up in rural Pennsylvania, nobody really taught their daughters to weld. It wasn't a skill you would give to your daughter or your niece or your granddaughter. And so I was just really interested in subverting that. And, you know, Louise Bourgeois, who's an influence on the book, you know, every night Jean sips her nightly Louise. She worked with giant, you know, metal cast iron figures. And Agnes Martin, though, she works in, who's also the other figure in the novel, Agnes Martin makes grids, right? So she's also drawn in her paintings to squares and sort of, I think of squares and boxes, the boxes that Jean makes. It's just thinking about confinement, right? Like there's something about the sides of a box that are so repeated and confining. And there's something I think about women doing something in artwork with squares and boxes, and they've always been put in squares and boxes, and how through their art can they sort of subvert the boxes they've been put in. So I think that was why I was very interested in sort of the geometric shape of the six sides. And then I worked with several welders who taught me how to make boxes. So I actually learned to make boxes so that I could recreate them in the book.
What was that like? What was it like learning to weld? And did you try making any of the sculptures as Jean might have made them?
Yes, I did. So Jean works with, you know, with serendipity, and which was very important, I thought, because when you work with discards, you kind of have to open up the possibility that the artwork will change depending on the material you find, what's on the curb, what's at the flea market. You know, you're not ordering it on Amazon, or you're not ordering it at your studio. And I think inviting in that serendipity, I try and do that in writing, to sort of like allow whatever I'm reading or hearing to always, you know, and I always try and read something I found on the curb, you know, on a regular basis. I mean, I buy lots of books that I want to read, but I also love just getting a book that someone threw away. You know, there's something really powerful about that, of like allowing for that serendipity. And so when I was working with these welders who all went about making a box differently, even though it was six sides, some of them would tack weld from the inside, some of them would tack weld from the outside. And one of them, this guy, Dan Neville, who works at the Center for Metal Arts in my hometown in Pennsylvania, I said, how are we going to make the lid? And he crouched on the floor and he picked up some pieces of metal that we had cut with the laser cutter, and they were just lying on the floor. And he said, how about these? And I was just, it was like one of those moments where you were like, oh, he really gets what I'm trying to do, you know? And so we welded those pieces together, and that was how I came up with the scene with the bits of mirror, you know, where she sort of like, you know, she falls, she breaks a mirror, and suddenly she finds her way to a new work of art. And I think that that's the, I guess that's the flow state I aspire to, which is, you know, whatever happens to crash, how can you put slivers of it into the next page, you know?
I want to go back to Leah and Jean, because at one point in the book, Leah says Jean is a complicated person. But do you think Leah is actually a complicated person? And what makes someone complicated? And where did the idea about repeating the name of a complicated person to quiet the mind come from, as you allude to in your first chapter?
Oh, I think Leah's definitely a hot mess. You know, she's very conflicted. And I recently met up with an architect who grew up in my town, and both of his grandfathers were coal miners. And now he's like, you know, teaching at Columbia University, and I teach at Princeton. So we were sort of laughing together of having come from this like very rural sort of working class town and suddenly being at these like what you're referred to as sort of these like elite institutions where we never run into anyone who grew up in a place where we grew up. And whether you bring that up, whether you don't bring that up, is coming from a small rural school in some ways a liability, depending on if you're at a place like Columbia or Princeton or not. And so it's just, and I feel like the answers to that questions is never a fixed thing. And I think that that's something that Leah grapples with a lot, is how to reconcile her current reality with her lived reality, growing up. And it's, I don't think there's any like, resolution that's final, right? Like it's just, it requires so much revision all the time. And I think that's true for, anyone where you live as an adult is very different from where you lived as a child and what's considered beautiful, what brings you joy, what do people have in common? Like when it's, and so you have these instincts and they can be at odds with, where you are now. I think I probably pick up more junk from the curb than many people I know. But, I grew up in a place where that was just like, that's what you did for fun. It was just like part of, like most of our bikes and that I grew up riding were like things found on the curb. So I just think that that's just something, I have there. And this the second part of your question, I lost the thread of it. What were you asking, Anna, the other second part?
Where the idea about repeating the name of a complicated person to quiet the mind came from.
Oh yes. So Horacio Castellanos Moya has a wonderful novel that I love and I've been teaching for a long time called Senselessness. And it's actually about the Civil War in El Salvador. And it is so powerful how he talks about somebody who sort of can't reconcile the information he's receiving with what he's doing. It's a very different story. But I really thought that the way you there's like there's something that he finds in the use of repetition at the beginning of that book that stayed with me. And I remembered it for a long time of disquiet in the mind and that notion of disquiet. And what do you do when your mind feels like you can't get settled? And I think that's how we are now. Like every time you look at your phone, it's disquieting, right? And how long after you read the news on your phone do you feel like such a loud shrieking sound in your mind? And how do you get back to feeling settled again? And so I just felt like that felt very much the time we're living in is sort of like there can be this quiet screaming internal experience where it looks like you're sitting there holding a phone and somebody looks like they're calm and you have no idea how loud it might be inside their mind. So like, how do we get back to that sense of quiet? And I don't know if maybe art and books is one of those ways that one can do that. If you can put the phone away, which is hard.
So you touch on the opioid crisis in the book. Why was that important in the writing of the novel?
Well, the region where I grew up was just devastated by the opioid crisis. Several of the pharmacies that, where they were giving out, I guess the equivalent of like, six opioids a day for a population of 18,000 people, that was like all around where I grew up. My town in 1960s had 100,000 people in it. And two generations later, there's only 18,000 people. So if you think about it, this is just a town that's like a spectral, tiny version of itself. And the people who stayed, who are not among the 80% of the people who left, right? For a number of reasons. I think there's like a deep sadness and there's like an awareness of absence there. And then you bring in the Sacklers, right? And you bring in all of these opioids and it just decimated what happened. And there was a scene I took out about the number of signs whenever I drive home to visit my family. About foster parents and the need for foster parents. And that is in part because so many children have been orphaned through the opioid epidemic. And there was something else, a lot of the hard stuff about the opioid epidemic, I ended up not keeping in the book because it kind of it was so devastating that I felt like it sort of, it became like, it just sort of took over the chapters because I didn't want to mention it and move on. I wanted to give it its due. And then I just realized it was just, you know, and very much another book. So I do think I'll write something else about it. But my stepbrother on the town, in the street that he lives in our town, his street is very similar to the street where I imagined Jean living. And there was a couple one house away from him where the parents both overdosed, and the baby died of hunger, because by the time they found the couple, they were squatters in the house, all three of them had died. And it was, you know, he didn't even know it was happening. It was like two houses away from him, and it was all over the news. But it's really devastating what's happened with the opioid epidemic. And I don't think that it's possible to write about it alongside other things, because it is just such it's all consuming, the sort of the depth of the problem and how unresolved it remains in the region.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us. This was, I mean, I have a huge author crush on you, and I can't wait to read your collection of poems, which is coming out soon. So before we go, can you tell us a little bit about what you've got coming up and how our listeners can find and follow you?
But I finish a short story, which I hope will probably enter the world. And then, yeah, I have this book of poems, which is very much about thinking about rural urban divides and the time of climate collapse, and what kind of problems people are grappling with living in rural places, and what they're grappling with, you know, in cities. And I think it's just like these two places I inhabit are so, you know, such drastically different places that these poems became sort of a place to think about that. Yeah. And, you know, the woman who inspired Jean is actually, she is in a poem that is actually up now at the Poetry Foundation. It's called That's How Far I Drive for It. So it's on, it's in their new November issue. So the woman who inspired Jean's character, I wrote a whole poem about Helen and a trip we took together to where Ida Novi, my namesake, lived. And I got this rhubarb that she had planted over 100 years ago, and I uprooted it and I brought it back to my house here. So the poem is about sort of digging up my ancestral rhubarb and planting it here in New York. So that is out in the world now. So yeah.
Thank you so much. And you can buy Take What You Need from all good bookshops. It's out now with Dawn Books. So although it might be hard to imagine, recording my monthly radio show and podcast at Radio Reverb is not my full-time job. In fact, it's not even really my job. I do it out of love and a lot of pleasure. But in my working life, and for the past 4 years, I have been working for an absolutely wonderful global writing consultancy called Jericho Writers. And I really wanted to take the opportunity to talk about them here with my excellent colleague, Sophie Flynn, who is also managing director of the company. So I think this Christmas, if you have been thinking of writing, or you have a project in the drawer, or if there's something that you just really feel like you want to say, that this is the year that you should do it. This is the time. So I am going to suggest that this year you give yourself the gift of writing and writing community. And I'm joined by Sophie to talk more about Jericho Writers. Welcome to the Brighton Book Club, Soph.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Sophie, what is Jericho Writers?
So Jericho Writers is, we say, kind of a global writing consultancy, and I feel like outside of our world, that doesn't mean a lot to a normal person. So we were set up about kind of 17, 18 years ago by our founder, Harry Bingham, who's also an author. And he originally started the company because he saw kind of a need amongst author friends to get their work professionally edited before they had a book deal. So he basically started it as an editorial service. And since then, we've expanded to kind of offer pretty much anything that we think will be helpful to writers. So we do courses, we do mentoring. My favourite thing we do is our online membership. It's my favourite because you get a lot for it and it's the most affordable. But yeah, we basically do everything, as you all know, as our events queen. We also run a huge amount of events. We've recently come back from the Festival of Writing in London, our in-person event, but we also do online events, things for people all over the world.
What are the benefits of joining, and who could this be really beneficial for?
Like, I always think about how I would have benefited from membership because alongside being the MD, I'm also an author. And I actually didn't know anything about being an author a few years ago. I'm not from a family or kind of a background where being an author is a normal thing. It's a very, very weird thing, a very exciting thing for people in my family. But I just had no idea where to start. And I knew I wanted to write a book, but I really, really didn't know how. And I also live in quite a rural area. So finding kind of writing classes nearby was really difficult. And I think a lot of people outside of cities will have encountered this, that you Google local writing groups and there just really isn't anything. So what I did was basically I did an MA, which was the nearest uni to me, which was Oxford Brookes, which involved a lot of traveling. I loved my MA, but in hindsight, I wasn't really ready for it. I basically needed like an intro to writing before going and kind of putting myself in debt for the rest of my life. And I couldn't Google Jericho writers because I didn't know that companies like ours existed, which I kind of see it as like multiple levels of access to content that will benefit everyone. Like if you've never written a word, you'd still find a huge amount of really, really great content with us. And if you just need someone, like I remember Googling how long is a book? Like I really, really had no idea where to start. And we've got loads of content for people based like that, right through to people who have actually already published books and want to keep improving. So I think we're a benefit to everyone, but like with membership especially, if you're just not sure where to start and you know you need a lot of help but you don't know the best way to get it, like it's such an affordable way to kind of dip your toe in and look at online lessons and meet people who are writing without having to kind of sign yourself up to something that's thousands and thousands of pounds and will take years of your life. So I wish I'd found it because I would be richer than I am now with my student loan debt.
How much is membership, Sophie?
So we are £150 per year, or you can pay that as £12.50 per month. We kind of do various sales throughout the year. On Black Friday, we have a really great sale where it goes down to £8.75 per month or £105 a year. So like it is cheap. It is very, very cheap. We try and keep it as cheap as we can.
Most people spend more than that on coffee.
I mean, I personally spend a lot more than that on coffee.
What resources do Jericho writers have available that you would recommend people start with once they've bought their membership?
So our events are really great. We do an event every week, which Anna, who is leaving us soon, but you will still see her face because we record all of our events. So Anna has previously hosted all of our online events, and we have those. We do a lot of them ourselves with the team because we have a lot of published authors on the team. So we talk a lot about kind of how you can get there. We're really there on like a one-to-one basis as well. Like my favorite events we do are our Ask Us Anything events where people just pop in. It's like a big online writing club. Basically, you just say whatever you need. A few of us will be on there answering questions live. And I'd recommend that as a great way to start because you kind of understand who else is in the organization and other people you can talk to. But also like we've got, I can't remember how many hours, but I think about 380 hours or so of masterclasses, which are basically pre-recorded things from authors and agents and editors that you can dip into, which are really great. You can use them at any time you want, or you can look at our video courses, which are basically pre-recorded video courses of tasks and homework and things to get you through writing. Next year those will be this is very techy and very boring, but from a point of view of someone who's running it, like the tech will be really good next year and you'll really feel like you're progressing in the sort of course you would usually pay kind of hundreds and hundreds of pounds for. We have about eight or nine of those which you can do at any time to suit you, along with a kind of cohort of peers to help you as well.
Amazing. Sophie, what are your top tips for writing a novel?
I think ignore a lot of the tips that you don't like is always my biggest one. Like when I first started, there was just I was so unsure of myself, and so felt like I was not the sort of person who got published. And I really let things like to be a real writer, you have to write every day. To be a real writer, you always want to write and you never want to stop. Like I took that to mean like I'm not a real writer because I had a full-time job and there was just no way I was going to write every day. And I still have a kind of full-time job. Like I work for Jericho 4 days a week. And yet I'm at the moment on my fourth book. I still don't write every day. I have never written every day. And I don't think most people do. Like if it works for you, it's great. But if there's tips and advice that are just making you really stressed, you can just ignore them. would be my biggest tip.
Sophie, how can we find and follow you and your writing? And how can we find and follow Jerrica Writers and look into their membership program?
So I'm quite active on Twitter, which I still refuse to call X. So I'm at Sophie L. Flynn on that. I do have a website as well, which is just sophieflynn.com. And Jerrica Writers, you can find us on pretty much all social media, just at Jerrica Writers. Our website is jerricawriters.com. And like one of my favorite things about Jerrica and why I think like it's such a nice place to work is because the team actually really cares and they are at the end of the phone. So like if you're listening to this and think not really sure if it's what I need or just phone up the team, like they're such a great team, and they'll be really happy to have a chat with people and give you some really excellent free advice, which is another thing I wish I'd known. There was companies where you could phone people and ask silly questions like how long's a book, and you get a real life person answer you, so they are always there for you.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much.